Welcome to My Favorite Mystic, a podcast about the weird and wonderful world of mysticism. I'm AJ Langley, and today I'm joined by Marissa Michaud. She's a PhD candidate in medieval studies at the University of York. Her work aims to illuminate the iconographic development of the mystic and Franciscan reformer, St. Colette of Corby, as well as to understand Colette's relationship with and patronage by the Valois court of Burgundy. Marissa, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I'm very excited to have you. Now, no points for guessing that today you're here to talk to us about Colette of Corby. But before we talk about her, let's talk a little bit more about you. How did you find yourself in this academic world of mysticism?
Yeah, kind of unexpectedly, really. So I did my BA in art history and then my MA also in art history, and I was originally not even interested in medieval art.
Well, I'm just appalled at that. Terrible decision making.
I know. I've just been moving back in time. I was really into like the Baroque and stuff, but basically what happened was I did an MA at the Courtauld Institute in London, where we specialize on one particular time period and movement. And I was doing art in Northern Europe, 1380 to 1520. And for one of our assignments, we're given this catalog entry type thing that we had to do on a less studied piece in a collection in London. And I was given this left wing of a triptych that we've lost the rest of it, but it has a nun and it had Anthony of Padua on it with her. And in researching the painting, I started looking into the Poor Clares and Franciscans because she's a Poor Clare. And I'm like, okay, what's going on within Franciscanism in the 15th century? And stumbled upon a footnote referencing Colette of Corby. And I was like, who's she? And started digging in on that, obsessed a little bit. And yeah, here I am with Colette and an unintentional lifelong obsession with her. And yeah, I'm really interested in like the politics within the period and general artistic movements. And she represented this convalescence of a lot of things I was interested in. And so then I was like, wait, mysticism's really interesting and weird and cool. And all these other mystics are really cool. And Hildegard, my love. And yeah, we've ended up.
Well, it's a wonderful place to end up if I do say so myself. And frankly, I do. But it's really interesting that you talk about coming to this through art, because one of the things I always find so frustrating is actually that we don't have as many artistic depictions of famous mystics or of their visions, and we end up with some really complex and compelling imagery, but we kind of have to piece that together ourselves and try and picture it in our own minds. So it's always nice when there is some sort of visual component to go along with this.
Yeah, so she weirdly has a very lush visual culture surrounding her. So we're really lucky because we're looking at a 15th century mystic and saint who experiences a good amount of success during her life. And I'll talk more about this. You get this really cool iconographic development happening alongside her. We have things that are done within 50 years of her life depicting her and her visions. And as an art historian, it's a really interesting thing to start to look at. Of course, we're not working with paintings like, you know, Van Eyck level things that are incredible, but we do have some really nicely illuminated manuscripts and stuff. And it's this really kind of niche, weird moment that's fun to untangle. And as someone that's not super grounded in literary studies, that was stuff that I had to come to terms with because I don't have that original background in like mystical theology or thought. And my knowledge is more based in visual piety in the church. And so within the PhD, something that I had to start to learn how to eke through, and why I ended up doing medieval studies specifically instead of art history was this realization that we have visual evidence, which is rare and useful and good, but there's also this entire other side to this movement and culture and person that's in the historical literature and in the hagiographies.
Yeah, I think one of the really interesting things about mysticism is that it requires you to be interdisciplinary. You need to pull from a bunch of different fields in order to make sense of these texts, to understand the historical and literary context, to understand the religious background and the theological ideas underpinning what they're seeing and experiencing. It really does encourage you to spread your wings and grow your horizons in a lot of different and interesting ways. But we are here to talk about your mystic. So, Marissa, can you tell us about this woman who you have admitted to being obsessed with? What do we know about Colette of Corby? Who was she and what was she up to?
She is born in this really interesting moment in history. So she lives from 1381 until 1447. Her life is spent in modern day France, Belgium, light bit of Germany and Switzerland. So she's kind of in that sort of eastern part of France and Belgium for the most part. And most of the territory she's operating in are what we would refer to as Valois Burgundy in the 15th century. And it's a really interesting time because we're coming in right after the Black Death, and monastic culture has kind of seen a decrease in admissions. And so you've got convents and stuff in various areas that had, you know, 80 nuns or something previously and now have 5. And she's also coming in a bit of a crisis moment where we're also operating in the period of the Great Schism. And that's something that comes up multiple times and something she has to grapple with multiple times throughout her life. But so she's born in Corbie in 1381 to parents who are described as being quite elderly. Her mom, it's her second marriage. She was widowed from her first with no children. Her father is a carpenter working for the local Benedictine Abbey in Corbie. And she basically is orphaned at a fairly young age. And she's been expressing herself as a very, very, very religious person from a very, very young age. Her father supposedly builds her mini oratory in their house. And she's a bit judgmental towards some others, but also a bit of an imitatio Franceschi happening throughout her life, where she's constantly giving things that she has to less fortunate individuals and stuff, just a hagiographic invention to some extent. We don't know how true that is. But once she's orphaned, she shops around a little bit for what form of religious life would work for her. First, she tries out being a beguine, decides that isn't quite for her, not strict enough. Then she tries out being a lay sister with the Benedictines. She doesn't have the money needed to come along with her admission to more established local monasteries. Like, she doesn't have the money needed to be admitted as a Benedictine or a Dominican. She spends some time as a servant at a royal abbey nearby, and then eventually lands on being an anchoress. And she spends 4 years doing that in Corbie, which is in modern day France, and eventually starts having visions. But it's a really interesting region to work on because all of this is at various points falling under the Valois Burgundian territories. And they're sort of an offshoot of the French crown. So they're originally the first sort of Valois Duke of Burgundy. Philip the Bold is related to the French king, the French crown. They're all princes of the blood during the Hundred Years' War. They at various are flip-flopping between who they like to support. They're warring with France. They're kind of playing to their own game. And it's a really tenuous and violent period in that region. And so her life is kind of surrounded by a lot of trauma in a lot of ways. And also at the same time, Valois Burgundy is extremely rich and wealthy. We see things, artists like Jan van Eyck coming out of it. We have major trade ports in Bruges, insane amounts of wealth getting pumped into the like arts and cultural sectors. And so it's this really kind of interesting moment.
I love this image of her shopping around for a particular religious vocation. I mean, this is not a woman who was given to a convent. Instead, she is like, no, I will take a religious life, but I'm going to choose the one that works for me. I love it.
Yeah, she's has a lot of awareness of herself and direction and purpose throughout her life that you see from a young age. She's really decisive and really opinionated in a lot of ways. She's kind of perturbed by how so many monasteries and convents aren't holding up their religious vows to the degree that she thinks is suitable and correct and just. And she's given some freedom in the sense that her parents die while she's quite young. And so she's orphaned and doesn't have someone quite lording over her. She does have the, I think it's the local abbot who briefly tries to say, oh, you should get married. Oh, you should do this and that. And I think a lot of the decisions of shopping around is her being like, no, I don't want to get married. I don't want to do this, but let's try this. That's not good, but I don't want to get married. So let's try this other thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're going to immediately get rid of the option of marriage, you have to look at all of the other ones critically. It seems like after her parents died, she had a surprising amount of freedom to make her own choices.
Yeah, so much freedom. But also think with Colette is she's extremely self-aware in some ways. She's really intelligent and very, very purposeful about what I think makes sense for her and what she can kind of get away with. She's very careful about speaking to her own mystical capabilities and speaking to her own like authority, even. Her Weetai frame her as being extremely humble, which obviously, but you can see this in her letters. Like, she's really good at admin and at skirting around the major theological issues within the church at the time. Because the 15th century is not the best time to be a woman mystic. We have various contemporaries of her that are not successful. Edith Becca in Flanders and Ghent does not do nearly as well. Obviously, Joan of Arc is a contemporary of Colette. They supposedly, according to legend, meet. We don't know if that's accurate, but she demonstrates an awareness of the church's in turmoil because we've got the papal schism happening. We've got a lot of very careful theological discourse about what is okay for women and women religious to be saying about certain things. And she manages to both demonstrate her own piety and her own beliefs while also getting quite a bit done administratively and skirting, getting in a lot of trouble with the church and local authorities, with some exceptions.
Okay, well, let's really get into this then. What kind of sources do we have to talk about Colette of Corbie?
So we're really lucky with her, again, and it's one of the reasons I'm attracted to her, is we have so many useful and interesting sources. So there's two Weetai written by individuals who knew her in her life. The first one, which is the one that I primarily work from, is by Pierre de Vaux, and he's sometimes referred to as Pierre de Rem, just to make things confusing. And he is her third confessor and spends a solid amount of his life with her and writes his Vie de Colette shortly after her death in 1447. And clearly at certain points, it is modeled after the life of St. Francis, and also exhibits many of the major hagiographic tropes that you can kind of find, but also has some interesting anomalies and some interesting things that it chooses to talk about where you might go, that's not quite the popular thing. It's originally written in the French vernacular, which is interesting, rather than writing it in Latin first. And then within a few years, it's translated into the Dutch vernacular and then into Latin. So that's a major source of information. My transcription of Pierre de Vaux's V is a bit over 60,000 words. It's a pretty substantial manuscript. And then we also have another V written by one of Colette's nuns, Sister Perrine de la Roche de Baume. Usually we're just referred to her as Perrine de la Baume. And that's written sometime around 1470, 1471, when some of the first canonization inquiries start opening. And Perrine spent much of her youth with Colette personally. And in many ways, it shares a lot of similarities with Pierre de Vaux's V. There's structurally some differences. Pierre de Vaux puts Colette's miracles into their own chapter at the end. Perrine sort of interspaces them and intermingles them with her account of Colette's life. It's a little less formulaic, but very clearly intended to bolster the canonization process that's happening at the time. I don't think, interestingly, that Pierre de Vaux's original Vie de Colette was necessarily written for the purpose of canonization, because it's in the French vernacular first, a bit anachronistic in some ways, and doesn't always read like something intended for canonization, partially, I think, because the church is in turmoil. And so it's instead possibly written to spread lay devotion, which is something that would keep the cult alive while the church sorts itself out. And so those are the two huge sources that we have, but we also have letters written to, for, and about Colette, and they're mostly administrative. You don't see too much of her personal self in those letters. It's, oh, I need to get to Ghent to establish this convent, but the roads are really dangerous, so I can't go right now. My sincerest apologies. And we also have various other accounts of administrative things. So a lot of folks allotting funds, land, time, money to establish Colettine convents, because she's a Franciscan reformer. So she's coming in to reform the poor Clares, and she's specifically intending to bring them back to their vows of absolute poverty. And to the extent that some contemporaries of her who are giving her the go-ahead are talking about her reforms as being quite extreme, they're concerned about folks being okay with living to that extent of poverty. But most of these letters and things surrounding her are written as these administrative documents that would surround what was a really substantial reform movement. She founds about 17 monasteries during her life, and is doing a lot of work alongside her mystical experiences, which kind of in these, we tend to play these like sort of asides of like, okay, she's really pious and doing all these things. And you can paint this picture of her through her letters and her Weetai, but also these miraculous moments are happening. We don't have, to my knowledge, any descriptions of her own mystical experiences from her own voice. She's really careful about what she talks about in her letters. And I think that's probably smart. She has folks talking about her as being a witch and an enchantress during her life. She has folks doubting her and demonizing her, but she's able to skirt most of that because a lot of her supporters are extremely powerful Valois Burgundian dukes and duchesses. So you don't mess with Philip the Good.
Okay, well, let's talk for a second about Philip the Good then. Who are all of these people backing this potentially scandalous woman?
Yeah, so her early life is framed quite positively. She kind of has religious supporters and friars and comes into contact with folks like her second confessor, Henri de Baume, really early on. And he's sort of able to, I think, help her navigate some of these issues. She very early on meets Blanche of Geneva, who's holding power in Geneva. And Blanche is also able to accompany her on her travels down to meet the anti-Pope Benedict XIII. So Colette originally gets her papal dispensation to leave her anchor hold officially and to also then turn around and begin reforming these houses of poor clares from an anti-pope. But she starts founding her convents with the support of folks like John the Fearless and Margaret Bavaria, Duke and Duchess of Valois Burgundy at the time. So you get this sort of dynastic and generational support from Valois Burgundy, interest in her and her cult subsequently coming from them. And a lot of the folks that are helping to fund some of her early houses are connected to the court or introduced to her through Blanche of Geneva, who initially connects her with Margaret of Bavaria and these really powerful and extremely wealthy political individuals. And they start founding Collatine houses in spaces that are sort of politically advantageous in some ways. Colette makes it clear that she's interested in founding houses in fortified cities for the most part, which I think reflects a knowledge of how dangerous the French and Burgundian and Flemish countryside can be during the Hundred Years' War. And she's being given funds by, there's a whole list of them. And I think the main ones to be concerned with are probably Blanche of Geneva, who we don't have too much information about outside of her involvement with the Collatine movement. And then the fact that she's subsequently buried in the Collatine house at Poligny, and that you kind of get these dynastic threads starting from these early patrons. So individuals related to Blanche then help fund and found a convent of Collatine nuns in Heidelberg in Germany, and more specifically and impactfully, Margaret of Bavaria and John the Fearless then kind of go through, and folks related to them. Not always. We have some convents being founded in France and not in Burgundian territories. But this goes through to Philip the Good, who helps to found the house at Ghent. And that's a interesting space because it's a city that is frequently tumultuous. It sort of is known for having quite a few uprisings against the Burgundian dukes. It's kind of a city that's not too interested in always being ruled by these French descended dukes. And they found a Collatine house in Ghent, and it's the language for it is founded by both Philip the Good and Ghent. And one of Philip the Good's many bastard daughters, Odette, is installed as the first abbess there. And you also see Collatine houses just being founded near strategically important cities like Besançon is near Burgundian center at Dijon, but not quite in Dijon. And you see these houses being placed in spaces that I think have an air of usefulness and this proto-Valois Burgundian propaganda attached to them, where you've got a individual who is not only being demonized by some, but also being celebrated by a lot of other folks. There's evidence of her being celebrated as a living saint during her life. Folks are supposedly keeping bits of hair, or her cord, or rope, or clothes, and that's got miracles being attached to it during her life, which is really interesting. And you see her getting placed in places that might benefit from a little bit of a pro-Burgundian voice that the people also think is on their side. And she is. She's really committed to poverty and the poor, and extremely so. But she also, to some extent, and I don't know how accurate this would be, but you've got Burgundy interested in her. And they, of course, are, to speak of Joan of Arc, they're involved in Joan of Arc being captured and handed over to the English. Specifically, Philip the Good's armies are involved in that. And so there's this sort of air of, oh, we've messed up with this. Look, we have a female saint in Mystic. And oh, look, she's cool. We support her. Don't worry about that other thing.
Yeah, I think what you're saying really brings home a point about the relationships between mystics and those who supported them. It's great seeing them get the support that they need in order to work in the world and have an impact. But you also do see these figures being used by those political powers in order to enhance their own standing. So this really is an interesting religious, political, social situation that shows that there's a number of factors impacting the lives and works of these individual figures.
Yes, and you see this really interestingly with one of Colette's aspirations in her life is she wants to found a monastery in her hometown of Corby. And the Benedictine abbey that's there becomes a massive problem for her because they are not going to let Colette found her monastery in Corby. And you sort of see, obviously, Colette, as I was just talking about, being something that can be used politically, but she also then, in turn, I think, does know how to call in her political supporters when it's helpful and beneficial. She's unsuccessful in founding in Corby, but you do see Philip the Good's wife, Isabel of Portugal, getting it involved and writing letters to the Benedictine Abbey and kind of being like, please stop blocking this. And there's threats of the abbots being potentially, I think, excommunicated. It gets to this whole thing where nothing ever comes of it. But Colette, I think, really does seem to express a strategic mindset in that she's able to both work within the parameters that life has given her in a really purposeful and interesting way. And it speaks to her success in reforming monasteries and the fact that she dies in bed in her convent in Ghent. She's not burnt at the stake. And there's benefits both to supporting her that aren't just political. Obviously, there's religious and pious reasons to support somebody like this. And her hagiographies and later canonization documents, which we have dossiers full of, speak to the benefits to lay folks that supported her, whether it be in miracles relating to everything from medical ailments and childbirth to really interesting. She does a lot of demonic exorcism type things and, you know, saves people on their travels. There's supposedly various moments where she's able to pray armed groups of soldiers away from attacking villages that she's staying in. And so there's obviously a level of, yeah, we can utilize this saint and mystic as someone that can operate as a potential form of proto-Valois-Burgundian propaganda for us, but also this is someone who folks are really invested in the potential validity of her miracles and visions.
Amazing. So let's talk about these visions then. She doesn't want to talk about them, so we have other people talking about them on her behalf. What kind of things is she seeing? What are these visions like? Tell me all about them.
Yeah. So speak to the, she doesn't want to talk about them, that other people are talking about. One kind of interesting moment that gets talked about in Pierre Devaux's Vie de Colette is that her second confessor, who I mentioned earlier, Henri de Baume, is also supposedly writing a vie and a hagiography of her life while he's traveling and working with her. And she finds out about this and throws it into the fire. She's really uncomfortable with the idea that her visions and her miracles are being recorded. But so her visionary experiences really seem to stem outside of, you know, the usual, like, oh, she's so pious and chaste and God gave her beauty at a young age. You see things beginning really when she's in her anchor hold. And she's in her anchor hold while she's in her teens, and she's fairly young, and she spends 4 years in this, and she's practicing various modes of extreme asceticism and poverty, and she's sleeping on the ground, no sheets, wood board for a pillow, hair shirt, the whole deal, mortification, moldy, stale bread, the whole deal. And she starts having these visions, supposedly interpreted by her, as meaning she needs to leave the anchor hold and go reform the Poor Clares. But she gets this vision of trees, and they appear within her anchor hold, and there's just a ton of small trees and one larger tree. And the larger tree she interprets as supposed to be her, and the smaller ones are the folks that she'll save from sin. And this is juxtaposed also with her visions of demons that start around this time. She has this incredible vision of hell, which is visualized in a circa 1470 Vita Colette that Margaret of York owns. But she has this horrifying vision of hell where she's sort of so terrified that she reaches out and grabs the bar to the window of her anchor hole and uses that to kind of pull herself out of it. And so those are two early visions that we get of hers. But then throughout her life, we're getting a variety of visions, sometimes that are useful, not just spiritually, but also, again, to this Colette as an incredible administrator. One of her most famous visions that you see depicted in art, and that's kind of an easy way to find her in the few surviving images. And trying to find things that depict her, there's a lot of just, okay, let's go through every visual database we possibly can and think of things that are connected with her and see if any of these could potentially be her. And one of those is her vision of Saint Anne. So she has this vision of Saint Anne and her progeny, which she sort of interprets as something, as an indication that she should allow widows into her houses, because previously she was only virgins, no widows. And it was also something that was difficult with her mother, because her mother had been married before, was a widow, had been married again, and she sort of viewed this as a problem. And so she has this vision of Saint Anne that kind of corrects this for her. And it coincides with a growing cult of Saint Anne in the 15th century in the Low Countries and in France and everything. And she also has another vision of Saint Anne that's interpreted differently by her two hagiographers, where Pierre Devaux in that 1447 circa V describes Saint Anne as going amongst the other saints and asking them for support for Colette and her foundations. Whereas Perrine in the 1471-ish V, she tells it as Colette's vision of Saint Anne walking around and asking for donations from other saints and martyrs, which I think coincides with an increased canonization thing on the chopping block there. So the Saint Anne vision is one of the main ones. And then also she has various other really, really interesting ones. Standard Arma Christi, sort of tools of, you know, the passion visions. She's frequently described as being in ecstasy and in rapture on her travels. She prays in a way that fire comes out of her mouth at various points. She also has a bit of a mystic marriage vision, where, again, interpreted in multiple different ways in the hagiographies, one where it's John the Baptist facilitating a mystic marriage with Christ, and the other one being a mystic marriage to John the Baptist himself, which is also juxtaposed with another interesting vision that Colette has of the Virgin. And she has this vision where she's quite ill and having trouble speaking. And Colette, throughout her life, exhibits various grievous illnesses, so much so that her hagiographers describe her suffering more than any martyr ever, because she suffered every day of her life than just during the brief martyrdom, which is an interesting hot take. But she at one point is quite ill and has this vision where this beautiful young girl dressed in white appears to her and kisses her on the mouth, and it cures the issue with her, I think it's her tongue. And she later realizes that it was the Virgin, because the girl kisses her and then disappears. And then it's this, oh, she appears to her in the sky. And you get this visualized in one of the miniatures of that illuminated copy of the V I was talking about earlier. It's really interesting. So you usually have mystics who are really interested in their mystic marriages to Christ, but here we have Colette kissing the Virgin on the mouth.
I love that for so many reasons, but I want to get into this different interpretation issue. Are we seeing the different interpretations as coming from the Vitae? Are these framed more as her presenting the meaning, or are they presented more as those supporting her interpreting them for themselves? How are these visions framed within the context of these works?
Yeah, they tend to be framed around the folks that are supporting her. We do the usual, this hagiographer is a really well-learned, pious individual, and this is our own account of the situation. We don't have any of Colette's words describing these or any indication of what she thought of them, and both of these are written posthumously. So there's no Colette reacting to them outside of during her life, what appears to be a general discomfort with folks looking at her as a particularly pious individual. She tends to take the role of this administrative individual who's on top of the order, not a religious or theological figure. And these visions tend to just be described as something that happened. It's written almost as you would write a story to some extent, where it's presented as fact. This is a moment that happened in history. In the really structured Vita Colette written by Pierre Devaux, You have a miracles chapter, which is the final one, chapter 20. And it's something that does seem to be built on and expanded throughout. And it seems like later copies have more miracles tacked onto them. And so there's this interesting development happening. But that frames it around individuals that were there. So it'll name somebody in the town and say where they are from. And this is how he described it. And with those, you'll have things where there's one where Pierre DeVos says something like, oh, well, I was not there, so I'm not going to tell you about this. He says something like, oh, this individual in this town says that this miraculous thing happened, but I don't know too much about it, so we're just leaving it out of this, which is a bit of a trope. But yeah, they're sort of framed as this happened on this day, and she had this vision of this young girl. And at the end of the Virgin one, it says it's guaranteed by her father confessor, Henri de Baume, who knew well in his conscience that this beautiful young girl was the glorious Virgin Mary.
Fantastic. Okay, let's talk a little bit about these visual depictions that you were mentioning earlier. What kind of imagery do we have associated with Colette?
Yeah, so we have illuminated copies of the Vie de Colette, and specifically Pierre DeVos' copy. I don't know of any surviving or records of any illuminated copies of the Perrine Vie. And also there's many more surviving copies of the Pierre DeVos Vie than there are of the Perrine. I think there's about 12 or so copies of Pierre DeVos' Vie de Colette, whereas there's only 3 surviving of Perrine. There's also a few abridged copies of the Vie from Pierre DeVos' perspective hanging out there. And so of the illuminated copies of the Pierre DeVos' Vie de Colette, we have one that's sort of 1450s that I worked on for my master's dissertation, which is also how this whole thing has blossomed. And it has 2 decorated pages, just a beautiful decorated floral border, and then sort of historiated initials, one of which shows Colette's vision of St. Anne and her progeny, and the other one shows Colette's vision of the Arma Christi. So it's not overly sumptuously illuminated. It's fairly modest. We know it was in Philip the Good's library. And then we have a bit of a later one that I'm really focusing on for my PhD thesis. And it was commissioned sometime between 1468 and 1477. I think it's the earlier end of that, but I'm working through it. And it's owned by Margaret of York, who is Duchess of Burgundy, married to Charles the Bold, who's Philip the Good's child. So sort of this dynastic interest in the Collettine cult carries through to Margaret of York. And it's extremely sumptuously illuminated. It's got about 32 decorated pages, and of that, 26 miniatures. So it's a really, really expensive and beautifully done up copy, where some chapters have multiple miniatures, some just have 1 or 2. It depicts various moments, and it demonstrates a real awareness of the text through the images. Like, you can tell there seems to be an awareness of what's happening within the Vie, not only in the miniatures, but also even, in my view, in the decorated borders, where we have this really interesting potential floral language happening with them, where you have flowers that represent things or were medicinally used for things like curing eyesight and vision being used in the borders, and also various other sort of patron-related plants like Margaret of York tends to, I've realized, have a daisy or marguerite in her manuscripts that has little red tips on it. And so you get this like patron inserting himself. And within the manuscript, there's a devotional portrait miniature of Margaret of York and Charles the Bold witnessing Colette's vision of St. Anne and her progeny. And St. Francis is there too, because why not, acting as intercessor. And you have various visionary experiences, as well as mundane, being visualized within it. You have demons scattered throughout because they're constant antagonists of Colette during her life. And you also have really beautiful moments of mundane but miraculous moments, like a nun who lets some wine spoil, and Colette miraculously is able to return the wine to a drinkable state. But the nun, she's messed up and Colette's here to fix it. And yeah, it's a really sumptuous and really, really, really visually rich moment, because you have all these visual indications of this cult that's alive and continuing to progress. And so that's a really useful and interesting copy to look at. There's also a abridged Vie from sometime between about 1501 to 1509, basing it off of the heraldry present on it, where it's an abridged Vie, and there's a frontispiece that shows Colette's vision of the trees. And that was owned by Margaret of Austria, who is then Valois Burgundy tapers off in 1477 to some effect, because Charles the Bold goes and gets himself killed in battle at Nancy. And Margaret of York does a very good job of holding the territories together to the best of her capabilities, while also advising and caring and for and developing this really beautiful friendship with his daughter, her prior marriage, Mary of Burgundy, who then dies in a horseback riding accident. It's really tragic. And I won't go too much into it, but Burgundian history is so fun. So,
I mean, yeah, it certainly sounds it.
And I should say, alongside these illuminated copies of the V, we do have some panel paintings that depict Colette, which is really interesting. We have a, I think it's about 1480s polyptych that's not for Colletton House or anything like that. It's now in Frankfurt, and it's a polyptych dedicated to St. Anne. And on two of the panels of the polyptych, we have Colette and her vision of St. Anne happening on one of them. And Colette appears again on another panel of the polyptych. And so you see Colette's visionary experience of St. Anne also being added to this developing cult interest in St. Anne herself. And then we also have a few panel paintings from Portugal that show Colette alongside Saints Claire and Agnes of Bohemia, sort of placing her as another important moment within the Franciscan movement for Claire's. And there's also a missing triptych that appears to have Colette in the center of it, experiencing her vision of St. Anne. And then it has two wings on either side. And I have a black and white photo of it. Might be in a private collection somewhere. Looks like it's about 1480s, maybe Netherlandish, Flemish, but it's MIA. So if anybody has seen it, let me know. But yeah, there's a really interesting developing visual culture of her happening outside of the bee and removed from the bee and her houses as well.
That is such an amazing collection of things to have. I would love to have some imagery surrounding my mystic. That sounds absolutely incredible. So two things. First of all, turning spoiled wine back into totally great drinkable wine, 100% necessary, all the time. Should have been sainted just for that. But also, we are talking about her as Saint Colette, but as you mentioned, one of the Vitae doesn't seem to have been written with canonization in mind, so we know that that is a process that happened later. Can you tell us a little bit about her canonization, but also the legacy of Colette of Corbie?
Yeah, of course. So she dies in 1447, and there is a bit of a push for her to be canonized at the time, but it's not too heavy. So she's not actually canonized until 1807. So her order seems to continue to expand and thrive almost at the exact rate that it was during her life until about 1520, about until her order is subsumed into the reform movements of Bernardine of Siena, which are running in contrast and parallel to her reform movement. So he has a different idea of how to reform the Franciscans, and Colette has a different idea, and they're both reforming things at the same time. And her order then gets kind of absorbed into it, and it seems to taper off quite a bit. Our idea of who Colette was changes a little bit over time. Today she is invoked for childbirth-related miracles and pregnancy. There are several pregnancy and childbirth-related miracles within her vitae, but they don't seem to be the kind of thing that's having emphasis placed on it. They're not the majority of the miracles that are being done. They're in there, but she changes quite a bit in that quite substantial period of time. We still have Colettine houses today. The Colettine Poor Clares are still around. The manuscript that I was talking about, the really luxuriously illuminated one, Margaret of York gifted to the Colettines of Ghent at some point before her death in 1503. And they've had it since then, although they've just left Ghent within the past couple of months because of low enrollment numbers and they're elderly. And so the manuscript is now with the Archbishop of Ghent, which has made things a little bit confusing.
Oh, just a little bit confusing. So what happens with her cult?
Her cult really does flourish after her death. There's recordings of folks regularly appearing at her convent in Ghent, which is where she died. And there's sort of people venerating her pretty soon after her life. Henry VIII also in 1513 speaks about how folks in Flanders seem to be very devoted to this Colette and writes in support of the church considering her for canonization, which is a really interesting thread that I wasn't aware of previously. And for anyone that's interested in the Vitae of Colette, I'm working for my own translation, but Renate Blumenfield Kaczynski has very recently published a beautifully translated copy of the 2B that makes it really accessible. It's the first time it's available in English.
Well, thank you very much for the book recommendation. I can only imagine that everyone listening is just as excited about the potential of reading about St. Colette as I am. Now, we are coming to the end of the podcast, which means we just have the one final question, which is, Marissa, why is St. Colette of Corby your favorite mystic? Why do you love her so much?
Ooh, it's such a hard question. I mean, I think the love started originally from the folks that are around her. I really have this love of the fellow Burgundian dukes and duchesses. Margaret of York is an incredibly interesting historical figure. And it started there, but the more time I've spent with Colette, I think there's just this beautiful purposefulness. And you start to get this crazy bond with someone when you've spent so much time with them. You know, when I was doing my own translation of the V and sitting there at my desk having a meltdown over old French difficulty at 3 a.m. and going through these heartfelt descriptions of this young woman who is living in this really tumultuous time, but also having these scary visions and the self-mortification and these like really painful moments surrounded by these beautiful, beautiful visions. You start to really feel for them. And there's so many threads of her life that are kind of radical and interesting. Administratively, she puts the abbess as someone who holds the role of Christ within the convent and kind of acts as this all-powerful figure that can admit and dismiss male confessors at her will. She's not really there as this more passive figure. She has a lot of authority and a lot of command. And just to have the access to these visual sources is so, so fruitful, and I'm so lucky for it. And as we were talking about the interdisciplinarity of medieval studies and medievalists as a whole, being able to look at her not just as someone that is celebrated as a saint, but also looking at her as this political actor, this person that lived in this period that is in many ways traumatic. There's so much to kind of convalesce in this one person. She's this assemblage of so many different things. And because we don't have her own writing, our view of her is this assemblage of images that exist of her, of witae that are written of her by people that know her, and then administrative letters peppered in from her and others about her and to her. And so because we have so much surviving, I mean, there's so much to do with her. So it's fun.
Well, Marissa, I can't help but to think that you are incredibly lucky for having all of these cool sources to work with. And we are very lucky that you chose to come today and to share them with us. Thank you so much for telling me all about St. Colette of Corby.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been such a delight.
It was so much fun to have you here. And thank you all for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at MyFaveMystic. And join me next time when I speak to Becky Field about the Cloud Author.